having it for a prestigious position. For a jihad, he gave up. Sarvabhauma, the emperor of the entire world. Surya Anbitam, blessed with all kinds of opulences. Translation. Mandhata, the king of the entire world, consisting of seven islands, was struck with wonder when he saw the household opulence of Sobhari Muni. Thus he gave up his false prestige and his position as the emperor of the world. Purport. Everyone is proud of his own position. But here was an astounding experience in which the emperor of the entire world felt himself defeated in all details of material happiness by the opulence of Sobhari Muni. So Mandatta, if you remember the story a few shlokas back, Yuvanashva wanted to have a child, and they did the yajna, and they were going to drink the sacrificial nectar, whatever it was, and he accidentally woke up in the middle of the night and was thirsty, and he drank it. So he got pregnant. Somehow or other, National Enquirer should find out about this. They could put it on their front page. They say that sometimes, right? Man gives birth, but this actually happened. So, as you may remember the story, he gave birth at the right side of his abdomen, but because there was no mother, they needed to feed him, and so somehow or other Indra, out of his power, gave him his finger and said, "You can suck me. You can drink me." And that's how he was fed. And that's what Mandatta means. Mam means me and Datta means drink. Is that correct, Panditji? Is that one meaning? Nurse. You can suck me. You can drink me. I can nurse you. So Mandatta means drink me or suck me or I will nurse you. So Mandatta was a very powerful king, and it had said he was the ruler. Wherever the sun shined or the moon shined, that's what he ruled. And said he was so powerful that even Ravana was afraid of him. You can imagine, because we think, well, Ravana, you know, it's like he's the most powerful. We get that impression. But here it said even Ravana was afraid of Mandatta. And so here, now Mandatta is looking at the opulence of Subhara Muni, and he's saying, this is amazing. He's more opulent. His homes are more opulent than mine. So I did a little research about material opulence, as I wanted to really see what Prabhupada had to say about material opulence, because sometimes we think, well, material opulence isn't good and we shouldn't really endeavor for it. It gets in the way of bhakti. And then sometimes we say, well, it's okay. It doesn't have to get in the way of bhakti. And then, of course, you have the verse, Bhogai Shraya Prasaktanam. If you're attached to opulence and just Maya Purita, it's just Aparita, you just lose your mind, you just become diverted. So I spent about 3 hours trying to, you know, really get the essence of what Prabhupada meant. So my conclusion was, after reading it all, if you want to be opulent, if you want opulence, just become a pure devotee. It's the best way to get it. Otherwise, if you work like an ass to become opulent, you may never get it, and all you'll get is the misery of working hard. Whereas if you become a pure devotee, you get love of Krishna, and opulence comes as a byproduct. But if you engage in bhakti, and you're not a pure devotee, then Krishna says, Harishe tadanam shana, I'll take it away because you don't know how to use it, because it'll just distract you. So that was my conclusion. If anyone is having economic problems, the easiest solution is become a pure devotee. Because then Krishna can use you. Right? because he knows you're not going to get deviated by the opulence, so he'll give it to you. And as long as he thinks you're going to get deviated, he's like, okay, well, maybe not yet. So what really did Prabhupada say about material opulence? He said that opulence is not a product of bhakti, and a devotee doesn't endeavor for opulence, but love of God is the byproduct, but love of God is the result of pure bhakti. But a pure bhakti has all opulence. A pure devotee, Krishna gives him all opulence, so he has mystic power. Everything that you could get from any other process, right? Freedom from sinful reaction, liberation, mystic power, material opulence, it all comes to the pure devotee. But he doesn't endeavor for it. It comes as a byproduct. And that Krishna doesn't want us to endeavor solely for material opulence, because the danger, we always see this danger in the Bhagavatam. You have this, Indra is always getting, he's always having this problem that he's becoming proud, right? Because he's got a lot of opulence. And so you have this story, Indra's, he's sitting in his kingdom and the Siddhas are there and the Charanas are there and other demigods are there and they're glorifying him and he's just loving it. And then Brihaspati comes and he ignores him. He was just, the intoxication of wealth then produces the intoxication of pride. And then Brihaspati just left, and then Indra realized, oh, I offended him. He realized I was proud. So you see this, Naluka Veramanigrib, you see this constant theme comes up, that associated with opulence is pride, that one thinks I'm better because I have money, because I have power, or I have something you don't have, so I'm better than you. And how does a devotee think? So Prabhupada says, it's not a problem for a devotee to have opulence because he doesn't become proud. Because he knows how to use it in Krishna's service. So therefore Krishna will give it to him. But if Krishna sees in any way that he can't handle it, Krishna won't give it to him, because it'll be the cause of his fall down. So it's dangerous, this example we have here. Now, it's kind of interesting if you look at this. Sobari is an ascetic, right? He was doing tapasya. It said he was actually levitating above the Jamuna. He was doing his meditation and he was going above. If you can, any of you have been to the Jamuna? So imagine walking on the bank of the Jamuna and you see this long-haired, gray-haired old man meditating on the Jamuna. You're taking your parikrama, right? And you come the next day and he's still there. And then while he's meditating, you see him go in the water underneath. And you walk and you walk down the parikrama path and you keep looking back and he hasn't come up yet. He's still under there. So he's doing these severe austerities. And this amazing thing happens to him. He sees two fish. Must have been Friday night. They're on a date or something, you know? They're out on the town. And these fish are hugging and kissing and so forth. And all of a sudden he becomes disturbed, which is quite inconceivable when you think about it, that someone who's that advanced in yoga would become disturbed. That's quite inconceivable for someone who's not advanced in yoga, that they would become disturbed. It's actually inconceivable that anyone would become disturbed by that. Could you imagine someone is guilty of some kind of sexual abuse and they go to court and they say, Your Honor, there's two fish in the lake? That was it. And the judge says, oh, okay, no problem, we'll let you go. And they think, this guy's, what kind of evidence is that? I saw two fish kissing and then I became disturbed and I couldn't control myself. So this is inconceivable. And then it's inconceivable that seeing that would instill a desire in the heart of a yogi to give up his yoga practice after he's done it for, you know, I mean, maybe if you only done it for 3 days, okay. How many years has he been doing this? Anybody know? Long time, right? So year after year doing this, so it's inconceivable. And then he goes to King Mandata. King Mandata had 3 sons and 50 daughters. He said, can I have one of your daughters? He's trying to keep it simple. And the king said to himself, most likely, none of my daughters will marry you. You're old. You're not beautiful. So he said, sure, if any of them pick you. You know, it was a good plan, right? Yeah, you can marry any of them. So he didn't have to say no. He said, well, if any of them want to marry you. So then he realized, yeah, okay, I have to do, what do they call it? Anti-aging. Extreme makeover. Yeah, that was the original extreme makeover. So because of his yoga power, he did an extreme makeover. And then what happened was all the daughters started fighting because they all wanted to marry him. I mean, all the sisters. So he saw what was going on. He said, okay, I'll marry all of you. And then he had who knows how many sons he had or children from each wife. Anybody know? 100. Each. So 100 times 50 is 5,000. And then he built these beautiful palaces which made Mandata the most powerful king around in a long time think, my opulence is nothing compared to this. So he, as we would say in the slang, he went off the deep end. Big time, right? I mean, he was just like, okay, I have a desire. I could get a, you know, simple used double wide for 15,000. You know, maybe I can, some devotee will let me put it on their land. I don't have to pay any, you know, rent or anything. You know, keep it simple. No, he wasn't thinking like that. So all of this seems to be inconceivable, that someone would go to such an extreme. And so how do we understand it all? Very simple. And the value of understanding this, it's so nice. Is it Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he quoted the saying, failure is the pillar of success, and we all know, we make a mistake, we learn by the mistake, we move on. The nice thing about the Bhagavatam, it has stories of so many people who already made the mistakes, so we can learn without having to make the mistake ourselves. That's better than having to make the mistake yourself. Especially when it comes to Vaishnava Aparada, it's better we learn from someone else's mistake than do it ourselves. Because once we make it, we may not make it back in this lifetime. So Bhagavatam is so nice because it has these stories also of people with qualities which we don't have, who are more elevated than us. So we are learning and getting inspiration from them of how to be like them, how to follow in their footsteps. And they were learning from the people who make the mistakes. So this story is so nice because we can learn a big mistake that he made. As we know the story, Garuda came into the river one day and he caught a fish, which was okay for Garuda to eat fish because he's a bird and that was his food. And plus he's an exalted personality, a parshada, associate of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, so you can't question what he does. So who would question what an associate of the Supreme Personality of Godhead would do? Why did he question that? Why? It is said that he was feeling compassionate for the fish. So generally you don't find a sadhu's compassion would extend to the point of offending a parshada of the Personality of Godhead or offending a devotee. That's not really compassion at all. And as Pran Govinda said, what happened because of his compassion? As a result of his compassion, he curses Garuda And he said, if you ever come back in this lake, I'll kill you. And somehow or other, Kaliya got news of that. I don't know the details. Does anybody know how he got the news? Somehow he got the news. So he said, if Garuda doesn't come here, I can come here. Because he wanted to come there. And so what happened? He came there, he poisoned the lake. What happened to all the fish that Sobari was trying to protect? They all died. Not only that, not only did he offend Garuda, he offended the inhabitants of Vrindavan because of him, Kaliya came, and now the lake is contaminated. And they could no longer utilize or enjoy the Jamuna. So they were offended. Then it said he, in his offense to Garuda, he committed two offenses. One was he instructed a superior person. And then the other one was that he actually was... it's one thing to instruct, but it's another thing to show anger towards a person. You can instruct somebody without being angry. So it was improper, number one, that he instructed him. That was an offense. And then he showed his anger towards him. That was a second offense. And then the third offense was he was an associated personality of Godhead, and he cursed an associated personality. And then again, the fourth offense was he ended up inadvertently offending the inhabitants of Vrindavan. Now, it's interesting. I don't know what Sandarbha Jiva Goswami says. If you're envious of somebody, that's one thing. But he said if you criticize them, it's worse. Because now you're showing it. Now you're actually doing it. In your head, in your mind, you might be critical. But when you actually criticize, that's much worse. And elsewhere it said, when you criticize, the person you criticize, you give them your pious credits and you take on their sinful activities. So if you're feeling compassionate, then you can criticize somebody. And the person who's being criticized can say, thank you for giving me your pious credits and accepting my sinful reactions. Now, one of my godbrothers told me he was doing Kartik Brat and he met another devotee and he said, what brat are you doing? He said, my brat for this month is not to criticize devotees. And this devotee said, in his mind, he said, what kind of brat is that? That's not a brat. You know, brat is like, you know, eat rice and dal with no spice. That's a brat. Or, you know, chant 64 rounds or, you know, do something. You know, get up at 2 o'clock every morning. So then this devotee, he said, that he started thinking about it. And he said, well, actually, maybe I'll try to do that. And it lasted a few hours. And he said, this brat is way harder than I thought. So if anybody would like to take this brat of not criticizing a devotee, and you try to take it for 30 days, you'll begin to realize how much you and I and we all criticize. So Jiva Goswami says, at least keep it to yourself. You know, don't speak it. He said, it's much worse when you speak it. So anyway, now we have this wonderful story. Look what happened to this great sadhu when he criticized. And it's such a glaring example for all of us of what happens. So, as I said, it's inconceivable that anyone would become any sadhu, austere yogi, would become attracted to grihastha life by seeing two fish mating or whatever they were doing. So therefore we understand the power of Vaishnava Aparad, that when one commits Vaishnava Aparad, then we could say it was not really, the fish were not really the cause of his falling down, it was the Aparad. This fish happened to be the impetus. And so we see one may be in a very exalted position in bhakti, where one commits an offense. From a very exalted position, one can fall very easily and very quickly, where practically nothing else could cause that devotee to fall, where practically that devotee is perfect in a sense in his or her sadhana, executing but that aparad. that one thing. Like they say, a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. There's a purport, and Prabhupada outlines the path of bhakti. He says you chant 16 rounds, you follow the regular principles, you rise from Mangalarti, you associate with sadhus, so forth and so on. And then he ends it, and he said, and do not offend devotees. So what do we understand? That all that other stuff won't work. It won't have its effect. Once you offend devotees, you undo it all. It's finished. So I love this story, because it's such a good lesson for us. It's like, look what happened to him. Now it had a happy ending. And why did it have a happy ending? Of course, when he had married, later on, he became dissatisfied. But, you know, he had all this opulence. Yesterday we were talking about Atmavit, satisfied. He said, he became dissatisfied. And then Prabhupada also says, Sati, her father was Daksha, her wife was Lord Shiva. Anything in the world, in the universe, anyone could ever want, she could get. And she committed suicide. And Prabhupada just said, just see. Material opulence cannot satisfy you. You know, you hear about these rock stars committing suicide. Oh, they had so many fans and they had so much money. And you think, oh. And it's common. You just go down the list, you know, in your head you can think of so many. And so Sati, anything in the universe, she could have asked Daksha or her husband, they would have given it to her. So Prabhupada said, just see. Materially, you'll never be satisfied. It's impossible. So here, Sobari Muni, he came to this point. He said, look, what did I do to myself? You know, he's looking at his 5,000 kids and his 50 wives and saying, what happened? How did I end up here? I don't know if you've ever felt that way. You know, you've ever done something and look back, you know, 10 years later and go, I think it's those of us who have big houses, 10 years later we look back and we go into each room and go, how did I get all that stuff? Which is one of the dangers of material opulence. You get preoccupied with stuff and shopping, and you know, your days can go just with buying stuff, returning it, fixing it, finding it. Isn't it? It's just too much. It's a disturbance. Anyway, so he came to his senses. He went off to the forest with his wives. And he went and began his austerities again, and he achieved success. And you know why he achieved success? Because it said, because of the mercy of Vrindavan and the Jamuna, because that's where he was doing his austerities. And he got the mercy of the Jamuna. Because of that, even though he offended Garuda, but still because he had done his austerities in Vrindavan and Jamuna, so because of that he was able to come to his senses, and then he achieved his what he would have achieved a lot quicker and sooner without all the trouble. So, the moral of the story is be careful. Now, there's a phenomena I've been thinking about lately about sadhu sangha. There's a saying amongst men, I don't know if women have the same, but there's a saying amongst men about women, which is, can't live with them, can't live without them. So I think that saying is sometimes similar to sadhu sangha. Sometimes it's very difficult to live with them, but we can't live without them. And it's interesting, when I was in New York, they're giving a class, I was telling you last time, a class called Gita Sutras. And in that class, they talk about sangha, the importance of sangha. And they also talk about the distresses of sangha. As a reality of sangha, there is distress and there is suffering in association. And that kind of comes as part of the package, that it's not always sweet and pleasant. But at the same time, we need that sangha. So it's a reality we have to accept. Yes.
enjoyment are other persons. I mean, did you read this?
Sounds good.
But it's other persons, right? So, I mean, we get suffering, adibhautik, adidaivik, adiatmik, but the most painful suffering or the most great enjoyment, it comes from our relationships with other people. So when one takes to devotional service, there's still some suffering and some enjoyment that needs to come to a person. And we don't associate intimately with non-devotees. At least we shouldn't. We're supposed to associate with devotees. So mercifully, devotees become the instruments of our karma. They become the people who met out our suffering and our enjoyment. And if we begin to see them, if we adjust our vision to see that these great devotees are actually facilitating our spiritual advancement by helping us go through the karmic reactions within the frame of our devotional family so that we can progress in devotional service, then we can have a different vision towards the devotees. So I thought that was nice in relation to what you were speaking.
Yes. Jwalamukhi.
Prabhu, I have a question about what is the difference between criticism and discrimination or noticing what is?
Sometimes there is no difference, and sometimes there is.
Because, like, for example, I think of criticism as you have some envy in your heart towards someone, so you say, you know, you say something envious because you're in that sort of intention, or you may see that somebody has, you know, for example, somebody has a hurt leg and they're limping, and you say, okay,
Abraham Lincoln answered this question. He said, he who has a heart to help has a right to criticize. But I think you also answered the question yourself, because you're saying you can monitor your own consciousness. And therefore you know when you say something, if you're saying it maliciously, as Sobari was very malicious towards Garuda, or you're saying it with another intention. But at the same time, there's still a fine line, because even if it's not malicious, the culture of Vaishnavism is not to be critical. You know, that's the... And the more a devotee advances, the more he sees the good in others, and the less he's concern. So, in specific situations, it may, as you're saying, perhaps it's necessary on a pragmatic level or managerial level to notice these things. But in general, if we understand Vaishnav culture and etiquette, the mood is always, the fault is me, within me. That's the general mood. Of course, if we're psychotic, that can be a problem for us. You know, if we have mental problems, then, you know, we can go overboard that way. But the general Vaishnava mood is... it's so funny, you know, as I was staying, I was traveling this summer, you know, and when you stayed in Indians' home, they just turn their home into your home. They serve you hand and foot. And then when you leave, they pay you for staying there. And the last thing they say after they've served you hand and foot is, if I've committed any offense, please forgive me. So that just exemplifies, you know, whereas if you go into the home of somebody else who's not in that mood, you might do something in their home that disturbs them. And they're thinking, they say, you know, if you're a guest, don't stay for more than 3 days. So after 3 days, your hosts are thinking, when are they going to leave? You know, they're so sloppy and they're eating all my food and, you know, they're making me cook 3 times a day, you know. So just, you know, the culture of Vaishnava, it's not like that. You know, so I think we have to be careful in terms of understanding the proper culture, at the same time be balanced and grounded enough that we can deal practically, and so everything's good.
Well, one other aspect of it is, like, for example, in your daily dealings with other sadhus, who are instruments of your purification, I don't want to use the word vent because it doesn't necessarily denote what I'm saying is, but you're a person who has feelings and all of that. So without criticizing, how do you be normal yourself and not just keep it inside with the idea that you're not being critical? Does that make sense?
So I think the first point to realize is who is at fault? Because sometimes we're the ones at fault, not the other person. It just seems like they are because we're taking something seriously because of our past conditioning or karma, and therefore what is bothering us may not bother somebody else. But if you really need to vent, then you may want to tell somebody other than that person, because that person, they just may be doing what they do. And also there's a cultural thing as well. You say, well, in America we don't do this. And then they'll say, well, Latin Americans do it this way, Indians do it this way, Americans do it this way. We had this interesting conversation when I was in, I hope this relates to the conversation, when I was in North Carolina a couple of months ago, Dr. Krishnamurti was, he's the GBC of Fiji, and he knew that I was in Mauritius. And so Fiji is mostly Indian, and Mauritius is also Indian. And he said, do you have problems there in Mauritius with devotees fighting with one another? Because we have that problem a bit in Fiji. And I said, yes. And he said, how did I deal with it? And I said, I tried, but I wasn't successful. And then I thought about it after he asked me that, and I said, are Mauritians or people from Fiji or other places, are they really more critical and envious than other people, or is it just a cultural thing? And the more I thought about it, the more I saw it was a cultural phenomenon. They're not really envious any more, you know, it's like all the most envious people, did they take birth in certain countries, you know? I was looking at it in a different way. So anyway, I saw there was some cultural conditioning that was affecting. I also thought that they've got nothing to do. It's an island, they're bored, you know? So it's like, you know, what else are you going to talk about it other than people's faults? There's nothing really as exciting as that. Anyway, we have to look at our own hearts. Yes, Mukunda.
Like-minded association, like in Nectar of Instruction, it says that devotees may be like-minded as association, and for them, the dati pratagrinati kuyamakiti prichiti, this kind of dealing should go on. So maybe like venting, for instance, we may find somebody like-minded, friendly, we can vent with them and so forth. But sadhu sangha is really a different category, because Jiva Goswami described who was a sadhu, sadnoti sadayati cha krishna prem iti sadhu. So somebody who has krishna prem is a sadhu. So it's not that just all association is sadhu sangha, we kind of connotate like that, but really there's like-minded association and then there's sadhu sangha. So sometimes in looking you may say, oh, I'm doing sadhu sangha but I'm still unhappy, I'm doing sadhu sangha but doesn't seem to be working out. We're doing like-minded association. And like-minded means we're aspirants. So being aspirants, we have faults. And I think if we understand that, then maybe there's some leeway. Oh, you know, I was with this person, but there's some unhappy circumstance. But we're both trying to obtain the goal different. But sadhu sangha is a different thing.
A broad category, yeah.
Yes, Hari Bo. I was reading in the Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, in the purport, and Prabhupada said that we get pious credits from thinking good about people.
Right. And you don't suffer sinful reactions by thinking ill of them until you speak. And the practice, we do this very interesting thing that I become aware of, is that if you pray for another devotee to bless them, particularly someone you don't like, that it is very purifying. And one devotee, before he begins japa, He prays to his god brothers for their mercy, and he especially prays to the ones he doesn't like. And he offers his blessings to those he doesn't like. And just in this last Japa retreat, I asked the devotees, I said, think of somebody that has upset you in the past and bless them. In your mind, bless them. And I said, how do you feel? They said all the enmity went away when I blessed them. It just left me. So that's something to consider. Whenever there's strife, one of the ways is to bless them. You know, sometimes a devotee will say, yeah, I bless them, but something bad will happen to them, so they'll realize, you know, how they hurt me. You know, it's not like, oh, I bless them that they'll become humble, so they'll know their mistake. That's not what, you know, you bless them properly. You know, they'll be happy, they'll be successful, they'll be Krishna conscious, they'll get good association, you know, all those things. That's a mentality. That actually changes the heart. So that's the culture that we're trying to develop. Yes?
I was wondering about the yogi and those fish. You know, so he's watching the fish do their organic thing.
Uh-huh.
So would it, just to parse the language, would it be possibly more accurate to say that awakened some desires latent in his heart, as opposed to just sort of injected something artificial that had nothing to do with
it? The way...
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I understand.
Because, you know, after all, this was a reaction to an offense he made at Garuda, and that desire was latent in his heart, and it got expressed, so possibly other desires were still latent in his heart.
That's
well.
The nature of aparad. But the nature of samskara... Samskara means impression. So impressions are made whenever an experience is enjoyable. Then what we call attachment is just a samskara of enjoyment, and we're remembering the enjoyment. Because you don't become attached to something that's not enjoyable. So any kind of attachment we have is a remembrance of the enjoyment we got from that particular activity in the past. So that samskara obviously was there. And to the offense, he could no longer prevent that from coming up. And so anything, you could say anything disturbed him. Plus, he was already deviated. Why was he, if he was meditating, why was he looking at the fish in the first place? So once we commit serious Vaishnava aparad, then, you know, little anything can therefore deviate us. So it's very... Sadhu Sangha is important. Properly approaching the sadhu, respecting them, and respecting all devotees. Yes?
How do we tell the truth? Without being branded as critical.
Ask Pushkar. Want to hear a funny story? I won't mention any names. Pushkar told me the story that there was some festival somewhere. I won't even mention the country because it might give away the names. There was some festival, and devotees were staying up late at night. And they weren't coming to Mangal Arati. And they're just, you know, having feast at night and kind of like partying. And so there was a meeting of all the leaders. You know, all the sannyasis were meeting, you know, one morning. And Pushkar, he was really upset. Was really upset that devotees weren't going to the morning program. He walked right into the meeting, just total Pushkar mood. And he said, you know, this is nonsense. You know, all the devotees are staying up late. They're not coming up. And therefore... you're all going to fall down. So he was speaking the truth because he said they all fell down. Now we're trying to still figure out if Pushkar's got Shakti to make people fall down, or they are already going to fall down. So I think you have to ask your question to Pushkar. He's standing by the door ready to answer it. I'm not qualified to answer it. Pushkar is saying, you know, the guy saw in the branch, you know, and you tell him you're sawing the branch, and, you know, he's like saying, shut up, and then he falls down. And, that's a very, I think, case-by-case scenario. But I was with another sannyasi. He told me, he said, he went up to one of the GBC years ago when one of the leaders was having trouble. He said, don't be so blind. This leader is going to fall down. And that GBC kicked him out of the temple. So, you know, it's a very sensitive thing. And that group ended up falling down. And this person said it was obvious to him. And he said to the leader, why isn't it obvious to you? I can see this. And he was asked to leave the temple. So, you know, this is a very difficult situation to deal with. Yes?
Excuse me. So my Guru Maharaj once actually told me, in fact, it was a very early instruction. He told me, he said, you will never be happy until you're teaching. And I think it's because I'm guessing that he had seen some newsletters I was doing on a regular basis and that it just had that propensity. So, of course, that
was a good truth. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm just wondering that when persons are given with that inclination and aptitude to be natural teachers, and a woman like myself will never take sannyas, perhaps, maybe.
Not in ISKCON.
Lakshmi Moni.
Not in ISKCON, maybe some other movement, but...
You know, but so, yeah, the question lies, how do we manage our temperament in that regard? I think that's the question.
Manage our temperament, or yeah. our inclination for service, or our psychological temperament.
The propensity to teach is there if with some persons. I guess it's with the connect with children and other younger.
I would say any service we want to do, that we take the initiative, and somehow or other Krishna will help us. I'm supposed to go somewhere now.
Okay.
And my wife's waiting. So.
Please, thank you for nice class.
I think I'd better leave. Okay. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
I'm trying to remember where it was.